Hey, please be sure to sign this and look it around. The proposal is our business. So let's get to that in a moment. Sorry, I'm late. I thought I could make it back here. Time to own. I forgot I had two swarms that I wanted to bring in. One of those mines. It's a tan Acura. Dunkin' Donuts created it. Right next to Dunkin' Donuts created it. Okay, we last time we spoke some about the Billigong, and the unique nature of his godless. Some of his specific contributions that he made that really might look at as revolutionary in a certain sense. In a matter of his scope, Norish Sab and Norish Balter and Nigla and Nister, and in terms of his emphasis on Girsa, the proper, if you say, authenticating text, and his return to the Makoros, going straight to Chazal, straight to Psukim, straight to Rishonim. All of these things combined, plus Hashgacha, combined to make him be considered in the status in many ways as a Rishon, which from a historical point of view, which is of course our interest here, shows that how aware we have to be of his position in history. The Rishon living 300-400 years after the Zman HaRishonim, not only a significance for Lamdus and Tzak, the significance for history too. We spoke somewhat a little bit about his relationship with the Chassidus, the Terem, and but I don't think I emphasized, I may not even mention it yet, is his connection to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. I've been thinking about the way I've presented these lectures, especially the last five or six, and I think I've been emphasizing maybe a little bit too much the defense against the Enlightenment, defense against all the various philosophical, ideological forces that threaten the fabric of the Masorah. And now that we're going to be soon beginning to look at the actual reform movement, and again, I'll be mentioning looking at a lot of Jewish history in terms of the defense of the battle against the Reform. What I want to do a little bit today is balance it a little bit. Obviously, that wasn't the only thing going on in history. It wasn't just the defense against Enlightenment and the defense against the Reform. There are many other things going on, too. And it would be wrong to just look at everything only from the perspective of the defense against the Enlightenment. Although you could look at everything, even the Derech HaLimud, and even the creation of the yeshivas, as being something which was in defense of the defense against the Enlightenment, and later the defense against various other philosophical and political alien pressures. But there are other perspectives from which to look at it. And I don't want us to lose sight of those perspectives. And one of those perspectives is Golos and Geula. Because I believe, and I don't think I'm way out on this, that one way of looking at all of history, Jewish history, well, all of history, especially Jewish history in the past 200 years, and maybe all of Jewish history from the beginning, of history, is as a process going toward the Geula. Because I'll say that there are two kinds of Geula, there's Be'ita and there's Achishena. That means, in historical terms, that there's one aspect of Geula which comes suddenly and in a revolutionary way, Min HaShemayim, which is the Derech Neis, which is not part of history, something super historical. But the other aspect, that's Achishena. But the other part of Geula is Be'ita, that there is an age, there is a time when the Geula comes about through a more natural, if it's an age, it's an age Nistar type of an evolution, right? This kind of growth out of history. And one way of looking at Jewish history is in terms of a movement toward Geula. Now, up until this time, the time we've been discussing the first couple of weeks, the middle, late 1700s, it's not so easy to see this process of Geula. Because if you look at history, it's been like a pendulum. The pendulum is swinging into the events of the Inquisition and the pogroms and the Shapside Tzvi and all these other problems that seem to be moving away from Geula. Even though we've already noticed in the 500 years that we're studying, there's a little bit of a return to Eretz Yisrael. Shulchan Aruch was written in Eretz Yisrael. It's a return, a little bit, but it's a very minuscule compared to the other forces which seem to be getting us deeper and deeper into Golus. In the time of the Baal Shem Tov, or from the time of the Vilna Gaon, the pendulum starts to, we begin to see the pendulum swinging the other way and swinging back to Geula. And that's why I have to mention here the role that the Baal Shem Tov's Talmidim and the Vilna Gaon's Talmidim played in starting to return to Eretz Yisrael, which is a process of Geula that you can see. Look at it from the Hasidic element first, but they, I think, were a little bit earlier, maybe 10, 12 years earlier historically, in terms of the return to Eretz Yisrael, when the Maggid, who was the Baal Shem Tov's successor, the Maggid of Mizritch, died. He left, as all great leaders do when they die, he left a certain vacuum in the leadership. Who is now going to lead this movement, which he really built? I mentioned that Mizritch Maggid took Hasidus and made it into a mass movement that may have, arguably, had most of Am Yisrael, or at least most of Am Yisrael in Europe, within its fold. Who was going to take over the leadership? And there were various candidates for that. Bahatanya was one of them. There were others. And one of them was a man whose name was Menachem Mendel, in the city of Vitebsk, V-I-T-E-V-S-K, city in Russia. He was the candidate, one of the prominent Talmidim of the Maggid, who it would seem was going to emerge as the next leader of the Hasidic movement. Remember then, the Hasidic movement was more centralized than became later. So were they looking for one leader? And he was the candidate for that leader, your position. However, he moved to Eretz Yisrael. He felt that it was time to return to Eretz Yisrael. And he led a group, reported to have been 300 families from Russia, actually from Ukraine, to Eretz Yisrael to settle. He settled in the area of Tveria and implanted Hasidus in Eretz Yisrael in a big way. Leaving a certain gap, of course, leaving a tremendous gap in Europe, which various people tried to fill, one being the Baal HaTanya, Shmuel Zalman, and others. And Hasidus began to splinter off into different subgroups because of its, of his relinquishing his role as a central leader. But Menachem Mendel Vitebsk believed very strongly that it was time to return to Eretz Yisrael. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah, something which both the Hasidim and the Snagdim, the early ones, had in common. A real strong belief that we have no place in Golos, and returning to Eretz Yisrael is a mitzvah. And this group returned. And Ad Hayom Hazeh, this remains the Yisod, I should say Hayom Hazeh, but certainly up until the Shoah, but up until 1939, that the descendants, spiritual and physical descendants of Rav Menachem Vitebsk and his Talmidim, were the foundation of the Hasidic Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael. It's interesting to note, Rav Nachum Vitez had a Talmud Chaver, whose name was Rabbi Avraham of Kalisk. Spell Kalisk any way you want. K-A-L-I-S-K, I guess, in English. Who was a Talmud of Menachem Mendel Vitebsk and who took over the Hasidic Yishuv of Eretz Yisrael after his death. And the thing developed, there was a break between those two and the Shemar Fnei Zalman of Liadi and the Baal HaTanya, and there was a little bit of a split. I think there are various reasons for the split. There are two kinds of reasons, at least two kinds of reasons. One is that Menachem Mendel Vitebsk really felt, really saw, I think this is coming up more now that we have access to some of his letters that we didn't know about until very recently. He really saw that an essential part of Chassidus was Eretz Yisrael. His vision was that what Chassidus was all about could only take place in Eretz Yisrael. It had no place in the Golos. And that's why he was in Eretz Yisrael. And he really thought that this was where the movement would be and only here. That part of the essential part of Chassidus, just like we emphasize other aspects of Chassidus, the Derech Avodah of Chassidus, the centrality of a tzaddik in Chassidus, he believed that Eretz Yisrael was an essential component of Chassidus, and that's where he moved there. And in some areas of Chassidus, some branches of Chassidus, this remains true to this day, that Eretz Yisrael was a subgroup. And my wife's family are she's descended from the Mojitzer Rebbe. And the Majitzik of Chassidim and the Rebbes believe to this day that Eretz Yisrael is an essential part of Chassidus. A Jew has no place outside of Eretz Yisrael. And the Chlal, we'll talk about this later, some of the Polish Chassidus, Ger, has this a strong component of Eretz Yisrael in the way that they look at Chassidus. Rav Nachum Mendel Vitebsk certainly believed that and lived that. Not everyone within Chassidus agreed with that. Also, they set up, for whatever reasons, more for economic reasons, they set up most of their original base in Tveria, Tzfat in Tveria, rather than in Yerushalayim or Hebron. And some of this had economic reasons, etc. They also started around this time the practice, which became a practice for a long time after this, of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael depending upon the Jews back in the European Golos for economic support. Setting up foundations, institutions like the Meir Baal HaNes and the various kolelim, not to be confused with what we use the word kolel nowadays. What they used to call kolelim were communities of Jews who came from a certain area of Europe and lived in Eretz Yisrael, would be supported in Eretz Yisrael by tzedakah, which was raised in the region they came from. So there was a kolel Poland, and a kolel Galicia, and a kolel